You're listening to Mommy on the Move podcast with Tierra Haynes. Hi, loves. Welcome back to Mommy on the Move. We all know motherhood comes in so many different forms. You can become a mom in the most obvious way, which is to give birth, duh. And then there's a host of other ways to become a mom, and no one position outranks the other. In every form, there comes challenges and a story that can be told from each one of those journeys. Today, we're going to take a bit of a different approach and talk about what it looks like from the child's perspective when it comes to not only adoption, but transracial adoption. We've seen it a million times in movies, right? White family takes in a Black child to help raise them. But what does that look like in reality? I'm so happy to have Lydia Berkey today, who has so graciously agreed to share a part of her story with us, but from the perspective of the adoptee. I found her journey extremely fascinating, not only because of the transracial factor to her adoption, but also the fact that she ultimately chose a career as an adoption worker and how her life has essentially come full circle. She is the founder of Adoptee to Adoption Worker on Instagram. If you would love to follow her, she shares some really great information and topics and just things that really make you think. And it was from one of her posts that I was like, I got to have her on the show so that she can share some of its backstory, because I just think it's so interesting. So welcome, Lydia. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
I'm so excited to have you. Like I said, I feel like we see things and talk about things a lot from the parent's perspective, but I think it'll be really refreshing and hopefully help some of my listeners that are, I definitely have listeners that have transracial adoptions right now. And so hopefully this is something that can be eye-opening for them to kind of hear, you know, maybe they have children that are too young to have the perspective that you have right now. Yeah. So hopefully this is helpful to those that are in it already or would be in it in the future or have friends or, you know, something, but just something for us to learn from it today. So I wanted us to start at the beginning a little bit and just tell us about your journey to adoption and a little bit about your history.
Yeah. So my name is Lydia, as she said, and I was adopted as an infant. So I'm a product of a domestic, private, transracial adoption. My mom's goal was to always put me in care. She could not take care of me. So I went home from the hospital with a foster family. And I stayed with them for 4 months. And on September 19th, 1997, my now adoptive family came and picked me up and took me home and adopted me a couple months later. And I was with them from that day forward.
That's awesome. Then now that's a different, I feel like that's an interesting take, like right from the very beginning. So
absolutely.
So did you have any connection with your birth mother at all? Any relationship?
No. So being that it was a private adoption, so that means that there is no contact at all. I knew very little growing up revolving my family. Now, when a child who's adopted turns 18, they can contact the agency or county that they were adopted through and find out some information. They keep the confidentiality of most of the family members, but there is some write-ups that led up to the adoption that they have in there. But that's the only information I ever had.
Okay. So at what age, since this happened at birth, at what age, I mean, and we've said transracial a bunch of times. So your adoptive parents are white.
They are. Yes. So they are white.
There obviously came a day where it wasn't like a huge surprise that they weren't your birth parents. Right. So at what age did you guys kind of have that conversation initially, and what did that conversation look like? Because obviously as you got older, I'm sure you had more questions and the conversation got deeper, but if you can remember, like, back to what did that first conversation kind of entail and look like for you at what age?
Right. So I always knew that I was adopted. We always celebrated. We called it our homecoming. So okay. The day that our family brought us home, which for me was September 19th, we would celebrate that. We'd go out to eat or my mom would make a special dinner.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of a day for us to remember that. So I always knew I was adopted. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a town that was predominantly white, like an Alaskan snowstorm. Like everyone was white. So that's all I knew. That's all mm-hmm. I saw until I was 4 or 5 and my parents enrolled me in a dance studio a ways away from our home. But they were very intentional about that so that there was other children of color. Mm-hmm. So that's when I noticed the contrast of, wait, these kids look like me. Oh, you know, I saw black families, I saw black kids, and that's not what I was used to. All the kids mm-hmm. in my neighborhood, all the kids at my church, all the kids in my school were white. So through my eyes, that's what everyone looked like until I was 4 or 5 and really noticed it.
Wow. That's deep. And so did they initiate that? Or was it something you were already kind of feeling, or do you feel like it just kind of happened and you were like, I'm black. Like,
right. I think it was a mixture of both. Like yeah. My parents obviously never hid, nor could yeah. they hide that I was black or brown. And I always had black or brown dolls too. And
that's beautiful.
Things like that. And my parents always say that people would say, oh, like her black dolls. And I'd always say, they're not black, they're brown. Mm. So I was very aware of what I looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And so my parents did have conversations with me, you know, you're beautiful, you're brown. Look at these other brown kids. Those are always conversations that we were having in our home. So I don't think there was an exact moment where they sat me down to talk about it.
Yeah. It was just a part of who they were and who you were. Yeah. I love that because I think it's so important, because there's I feel like there's this stigma where it's like you have to have this talk about what you look like, or you know, so the fact that they were already so aware and cognizant and I mean, even as black parents, sometimes we forget to tell our kids how beautiful their black skin is, right?
Right.
Just because, not in contrast to somebody else calling it ugly. You know, right. I feel like Absolutely. We have that. Yeah, I feel like we have that experience a lot, where we have a negative experience with our blackness, and then our parents have to reinforce the beautifulness after.
Absolutely.
Like as an afterthought. And so I love that they did it before, and it was just a part of the conversation and just who they were as parents. I love that. Yes. I love that.
Yeah.
So what were some interesting things about having an interracial family?
Well, growing up, I didn't enjoy going places with my parents.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because I was embarrassed of them. It was the stares that got yeah. to me. People were always trying to figure out what the connection was. And mm-hmm. they still do. I stand mm-hmm. in line at the grocery store with my mom and people are like, okay, y'all are separate. And I'm like, no, this is my mom. Like,
right.
And when we go out to eat, people are like, separate checks. And my dad's like, no, that's mm-hmm. my child. Like,
yeah.
People are always trying to figure things out. And once they do, a lot of times people feel like they can give unsolicited advice or make out of pocket statements.
Yeah.
I feel like my friend, when she was pregnant, she said, you know, people would always come up and say things or give her unsolicited advice. And that's mm-hmm. kind of how I felt. I felt yep. like people were always, wow, you should be so thankful for your parents. Yes, I am. But I didn't ask to be born into this world just like your birth child. My parents mm-hmm. chose this.
Right.
And my personal opinion, I don't owe them more than your birth child does.
Right.
I'm forever grateful, but I don't need to worship the ground that they walk in, and they don't expect me to.
Right.
And so there was always those sorts of comments, or all growing up, I was always called an Oreo. There's no way you're really black because you were raised by white people.
Mm-hmm.
And that always haunted me, and it still does, that people just felt entitled to share what they thought about my life.
Right. You know, and it's funny, obviously, I wasn't raised by white people, but
right.
But there is this stigma of when you grow up, if you live in, you know, the suburbs, if you talk right. a certain way, if you read a book, God forbid you read a book, right?
Listen.
You know, you participate in certain activities. I was in the marching band.
Yes, me too.
You know, so it's like all of those things. And they're like, oh, you act white. Well, what does that mean that I'm culturally, you know, right. educated and I have diverse experiences? Then that means that, because Black people are allowed to have those experiences.
Right, exactly.
And it's almost like, that was kind of why I brought up in the beginning, the movie thing, because I feel like Hollywood always paints this picture of like white people swooping in with their Superman capes on to say, blindside effect, right? To
the white savior complex.
This poor Black child from the horrible life that they've experienced.
Yes.
And, you know, we're supposed to worship this holy white savior, right? Which,
right.
you know, obviously in real life, that's not how it goes. There's a parent, there's a person, there's a family that feels led to share their experience and to try to give, you know, I feel like this is to put yourself in the situation of taking in someone else's child, because they don't know what you're gonna heck, I birthed my own kids and half the time I don't know what I'm like, who birthed you? Where did you right. come from?
Right.
And so obviously there's no comparison, but like I was really invested in your story because we took my niece in last year.
Yeah.
And she lived with us. And in a lot of ways, I felt I can't say the same experience because I haven't had that experience, but I felt right. like I was having a similar experience to an adoption where you think you know what you're going to get, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then you're looking at this kid and you're like, oh, it's real.
It gets, yes, yes.
And so it's just a very different experience. And that was honestly, for me, after 11 years of being a mom, I realized that there are so many other, that was when it really hit me, that there's so many other ways to being a mom. And yeah. I learned so much in that role of taking in my niece that I would never have only learned just from raising my own boys. And granted, it was just 1 year, but right. I had a lot of really different experiences from the parent's perspective, but I was able to see things from her perspective to eventually, once I got out of my feelings about certain things, right? Because I'm still, right. God is still working on me. So. But it's tough. And, you know, luckily, I'm saying luckily kind of facetiously, like she's our family. She's our blood right. family. So she looked like the boys. So people knew that we were related, but they also knew that I didn't have a girl. So they were all right. like, it was kind of that same thing where people would be like, well, we're trying to figure out where yes. she, like people that we knew, like, where did this little girl come from? And
exactly. exactly.
And so trying to explain that. And then, you know, people being like, oh, are her parents on drugs? No, they're alive and well, and they live about right. 45 minutes away, but we have her. Thanks for
exactly.
asking.
Exactly. And it's so important to keep that child's privacy and for them, yes. to, you know, to not expose that. And so I don't remember a lot of conversations my parents would have with random people, but I know they were, you know, they were creative in being nice to these people, mm-hmm. but also being like, this ain't your business, right? Like,
exactly.
This is my child, and that's yeah. what you need to know, period.
Yeah. And that's why I say parenthood comes in so many different forms, because they protected you like I absolutely. Would, you know, like you would protect your own kid because you were their kid.
Exactly.
So, absolutely. And you were all they knew, and they were all you knew. And yes. so y'all are family, and there's nothing else to say about that.
Exactly.
So what are some of the, I mean, we kind of touched on it a little bit. What are some of the other struggles that came? Because obviously adoption is difficult in itself.
Right.
When it comes to, you know, obviously our families is where we gain our identity from. You know, yeah. I'm able to look at my mom and see certain features. I'm able to look at my dad and see, you know, my personality come out in certain ways. And so for you growing up, obviously that was a totally different experience. And so what was that like? Not only, you know, obviously adding that extra layer of having white parents.
Right. So that was something I actually didn't fully experience until college, because my mom was a stay-at-home mom for the first years of my life, and she would come and help a lot in the classroom and do things like that. So everybody knew, they knew my parents. My parents were always around.
Yeah.
So I never had to explain that. When I went to college, it was different. I was getting to know these people, and you would see there and people would sit with their phones showing people pictures. Oh my gosh, you look just like your mom. You talk like her. Like, you could see those connections and resemblances that I had never had. And I never just sat down and thought about that as much. And that's the whole debate of nature versus nurture. I definitely believe that there are things that I've picked up from my family, my parents. My dad has a very dry sense of humor, and that is, he's goofy, goofy, goofy. And I'm the same way. But I do think it is definitely challenging when you don't see anyone who looks like you.
Yeah.
I don't know who I get my eyes from. I don't know who I get my nose from. I don't know, you know, things like that. And it was definitely challenging growing up, just feeling like I was kind of alone on an island with no one.
How do you feel like you overcame that? Because that's, I mean, that can be very damaging to your, that, I mean, that can create a whole identity crisis in its own, right? You know what I mean? Like, how do you feel like
it was?
Yeah. I mean, how could it not? You know, how do you feel like you, or did you overcome that? I mean, you know what I mean? Do you still have lasting effects of that, or what does that look like? How did it manifest even into today?
Yeah, I do still have those feelings. I mean, adoption is a loss. So adoptees go through the grief process that you would if someone died. Like, I grieve the family that I didn't have.
Right.
And so it's been a process. And in college, I went to counseling when I had this whole identity crisis of not knowing my background and not looking like anyone. And now, being an adoption caseworker, some of those things have resurfaced.
Yeah.
Dealing with, you know, writing these reports that these children will get when they're 18. And I feel a responsibility to, you know, let them into their life and show them a piece of it that they don't know. But it definitely is hard. And I think it's a lifelong journey. I don't think it has ended.
I love that you said you went to counseling.
Yeah.
It's another thing, and you know, in the Black community, is, you know, we're so scared to talk about mental health and actually, God forbid, we actually go get help and pray. Right. You know, like, what is that? But I love that you did that, because it's going to be a journey. It's probably, like you said, it's a grieving process. And the thing about grief is it never really ends. It just changes.
Right.
And so you'll continue to have, you know, I'm sure those things as you have kids and you grow your family,
for,
you know,
sure.
You'll continue to mourn that piece of yourself that you never got to meet. And so I love that you sought out the help that you needed, especially at such a young age and at such a crucial age when our identities are already being rocked anyway, as it is.
Right.
You know, college is like, what? What is this? Did you ever feel like, you know, we were talking about the Oreo thing. Did you ever feel like this pull on not being Black enough for the Black people and then not being white enough for the white people? Like, did you ever feel that tug between
those
two worlds? Yeah,
absolutely. So code switching was my life. I
don't
have Black friends, and I talk different to them than I talk to my white friends, because that's just how it is.
Yeah.
But I definitely felt insufficient in both sides.
Yeah.
Right. My white friends would be like, you're sassy, or, oh, she about to go ghetto. Like, I had that. But then my white friends were like, you don't know this hip hop music, or, girl, that's because you hang out with those white people,
right?
With them white folk. And so I did have this feeling of never fitting in. And when I was younger, I would try and mask it. You know, I'd hang out with my Black friends and, you know, pretend to sing along to whatever they was listening to. And with my white friends, I tried really hard to not be sassy and talk in a certain way. And It was definitely difficult, and I have just embraced who I am. I talk the way I talk. When I get mad, That's what it is. Like, I
my big old neck rolling involved. Listen, and some eye roll and eye popping and
and I clap my hands and I click my tongue. That's how it is. That's me. And that doesn't make me less Black or more Black. I am a proud African American woman. And mm-hmm. that's what it is. And people can take it or leave it.
And I love that you have that pride, and it's something that comes from, you know, our background. And right. so obviously your parents gave you the room to be that and to have that. And so I'm wondering, because I've had white parents ask me, like, when do I have this conversation, or how do I even I've got a lot of friends that are, they're interracial. And so right. maybe both parents are not white, but maybe one of the parents is white and the other parent is Black. And so obviously we don't learn anything about our heritage in school other than Martin yes. Luther King and slavery. That's pretty much it.
Yes.
And so I had one of my white friends ask, how do I introduce Black culture and Black history to my kids? And so I'm wondering if that happened in your household and how.
Yeah, I think my parents, I read Black books growing up. There was
choice, or did they, you know, like, how did that happen? Like, did they just...
They just had, like, they found those books, whether it was like the Addie American Girl doll books. When I was like in middle school, I would read those. And when I was younger, since I was a dancer, they found these brown ballerina books that I would read. I grew up watching the Ruby Bridges movie. My parents are really into music. So I grew up listening to Stevie Wonder and the Supremes and Michael Jackson and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think introducing it, there wasn't like a moment. It was just always there. And we did have conversations. You know, there was more history and heritage. And we would go to these Black History Month programs every year. And I'd gain a lot of information from those. And we'd go to art exhibits or museums about African American history. So they were just always trying to find things so that we did have that.
I love that. And I love that it was just, like you said, the key thing, it wasn't like this, okay, let's sit down and talk about Black people today. Like, it was just this recurring thing. And that was kind of what I shared, was just to make things available in your house. The same way that I do. We have books with white characters. We also have books with Black characters, Hispanic characters,
right.
you know, like Asian character. We have books with all types of people, but I also, you know, make sure that our heritage is predominant in our home, because it won't be anywhere else.
Yeah.
And so I understand that if the majority of the books in a white home are of white characters, but do you have some that include Black characters too? And, you know, if not, right. I'll give you a list of really great books that
exactly
highlight Black people in another way besides slavery and marching on on the hill. Like, we're a vast people, trust me. And it's just, you know, different things. Like, you know, my kids came home and were like, Martin Luther King Day just passed.
Right.
And even just talking about the narrative of Martin Luther King was very passive. It was very, he died for our rights. Well, he was murdered. Didn't just die. You know what I mean? Just like different things like that. And just making sure that at home is where they're going to get that stuff. They're not going to get it in school. And so just being cognizant and conscious of having those conversations, those real conversations. And they're not easy, even when they're Black, when you're Black, they're not easy conversations to explain to your 5 and 6 year old that a man was murdered for fighting for equality. Exactly. That's tough. And to explain to them, you know, I had to break it down. Obviously they're young, but to say, you know how Johnny's your best friend? Well, in 1958, he couldn't be your best friend. You guys would have had to be at totally different schools, and your school would be dirty and nasty, and you would have no books. Exactly. And they were like, what? That's crazy. And I'm like, yeah, I know. And it wasn't even that long ago either.
Right.
So, you know, just breaking it down and having those real conversations, I think, is really important because that's the world that we live in. And I think people are afraid to dig into the dirtier parts of our the American history, you know, what it looks like for people, for everybody. But it's so important for children of all color to understand this country's history. And so that way we can go somewhere different and be somewhere different. I feel like I'm getting off on a tangent, but
that's good. And that's
so turned important. Into a whole moment, but I get, I'm black all year, but February I get blackity black. So
listen,
let me take it back a little bit. All right. So my number one question is always this, and I have been guilty. I have to be honest. When I see black kids or mixed kids with their white parents and their hair is not together, honey,
listen,
a part of my soul is crushed and just dies. And I just want to, I never see. And then I want to become one of those parents that give unsolicited advice like, sis, all you need is a little bit of, you just need a little spray bottle. So what was the hair conversation like in your house, and what did that look like?
Right. Well, I'll start off by saying I do the same thing because I'm an adoption worker. I work with white parents all the time that have children of color in their home. And when I tell you, baby, I want to bring my coconut oil with me and just let me get them edges together. Right.
And the edges and the elbows, because, you know, they're ashy. Poor babies.
They're dusty, crusty.
They are. Those babies.
I even have to take a step back, especially since it's a professional environment, to not overstep those boundaries.
Right.
But what I will say is my mom is the bomb. And she learned how to braid. So my mom can do some mad cornrows.
Okay.
And I always grew up with barrettes in my hair, the beads at the end. We would color coordinate it with my outfits and all of that. So my hair was always moisturized and looking good.
I'm so obsessed with your mom right now.
I took that for granted. I didn't realize that there were other black kids becoming bald headed because their parents weren't doing that. And so I am so grateful for that. My mom used to wash my hair at night. She'd braid it while I was asleep and I'd wake up with a new do.
Come on, mom.
Yes.
So let's talk about this, because you have other siblings as well. So let's talk about what your whole family unit looks like.
Yeah. So my parents are white. I have an older brother. He's about 2.5 years older and he is Caucasian. And then I have two younger siblings, and I'm 5 years older than my brother. He's 17, and then my sister's 16, and they're 13 months apart. So we kind of called them the twins. They did everything together.
They're like Devin and Dallas, right?
Okay. Yes, they are. Right.
And so the two younger ones, are they black or white?
They are black. The two youngest are black as well.
And so the older brother, is he their birth son or is he adopted as well?
He is also adopted. Yeah.
Okay. Look at them.
Yes.
That's amazing. I always there's a special place in heaven for people that can do this. I promise you, seriously. Yes. Okay. So you were their first black child.
I was.
Wow. And how brave of them. I mean, because from where you described where you guys lived, I'm sure that was difficult for them too, because, okay, so here's a misconception that I had, and I watched a Red Table Talk with Jada Pinkett, and I can't remember her real name, but old girl from Sex in the City, and so I really did have it made up in my mind. I was one of those people that was like, these white folks just going out here just scooping up black babies, huh? That I really had that in my mind,
right?
You know, that's not how it works. And so, you know, listen, I'm never one to hold back or to shy away from where I've been wrong. And I was absolutely wrong about that part of the process where I thought that you could just circle, like, give me all your black babies, or, you know what I mean? I don't know. Like, so she made it very clear that that's not what happens, that you could get anything and anyone from any, you know, background. And so you just kind of have to be prepared for anything, for everything.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm wondering, have you guys ever had that conversation where were they like, oh, she's black, all right, you know what I mean? Like, did, or, you know, did they go to the did they choose you? Like, how, you know, how did how did that process go?
So they went through a private adoption agency, but their caseworker did talk with them. Obviously, there's a disproportionate amount of children of color in the child welfare system.
Yes.
So, and that's exactly what I do. I make families aware of that.
Yeah.
And my mom knew that taking on raising a Black child would be a lot.
Yeah.
And so for her first adoption, they knew they were going to adopt more kids. But for their first one, she thought it would be best to, you know, start motherhood out with a white child, something that she knew. And she told me that once my brother came home, she was like, oh, I got this. And
right
at this point, I will take any child. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But I think that is important that she was able to do a self-assessment and look at what she was able to give to a child.
It's honest, and it's a level of honesty that you have to have.
Absolutely.
Because it takes a certain level of service to take in a child of another culture. Because listen, if I was to get a white kid, I would be a little, you know what I mean? Or or an Asian. I am not educated in their culture, and it takes a high level of putting yourself aside to take in a child who not only will they have all these, you know, emotional and physical and, you know, all of those things,
absolutely, but then
now you add in another piece of a different culture and it changes the game real fast.
Absolutely.
And so I think it is, like you said it exactly right. It's a self-awareness that you have to go in with in order to be able to say, I'm ready or I'm not ready.
Like, right. Exactly.
And that's okay. I love that. I love that honesty. So which part of, you know, how does this all come together for you to ultimately say, like, at what point did you say, I want to go into adoption and be an adoption worker? How did that happen?
I was in eighth grade.
Wow.
It was called career cruising, and we did one of those tests as to what you would be when you grow up. My first one was a bartender, and my second one was a social worker, and I had no idea what that was.
Yeah.
So I looked into it and I was like, yep, that's what I want to do.
Wow.
And I remember when my two younger siblings were adopted. I remember their caseworker, and she was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
She would come to our house. I would ask to stay home from school because I loved her, and I saw how much she loved our family.
Yeah.
And the impact that she had on our family's life was life-changing.
Wow.
And I wanted to do that as well. I wanted to have those personal encounters with families and allowing them to adopt children, which is what mm-hmm. they were passionate about. And I remember she came to my sibling's baptism and she sobbed. Like,
oh,
it was the reward that she felt for having this child placed in a home that loved them wholeheartedly. I needed to do that. Like, I needed that feeling in my life.
Now, what is the balance between that feeling and the opposite, obviously?
So being an adoption caseworker is hard.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just say that. And I work mostly with teens. Most of my foster kids are teenagers, and it's really hard. And there are days where I get really upset with them because I'm like, I care about you. I love you. I want the best for you. Stop fighting in school or stop whatever.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I don't need that external reward of seeing them, you know, accomplish what they need to. I hope to plant seeds within these children.
Wow.
And have that help them in the long run. I don't need to see them succeed in my time working with them. And so that's just what I've come to terms with. That way, you know, I can sleep at night and leave work at work.
Yeah. Woo. That was a word. I feel like I need to, I literally got butterflies in my stomach when you just said that, because no, you don't understand, like, even in how that translates to parenting.
Right.
I'm not going to cry. That's so deep, Lydia. Like, I don't even know if you understand. I can't speak for anybody else, but
right.
especially like it just in this season of having a preteen, Lord Jesus, help me.
Help Jesus, me. Be offense.
Be offense. Because you know what I mean? When they're small, you do get those kind of like quick jolts instant gratification.
Right,
that's the word
exactly.
I was looking for. Where you're trying to teach them how to walk and then you see them walk, you're like, oh my God, taught them that. Or you're trying to teach them how to read or, you know, spell their name. And you get these moments of instant gratification and then they turn like 10 and you don't know who's been raising them for the past 10 years or who will continue to raise them.
Because it is you.
If they can continue to live because you might end their lives. Like, it's a whole thing. And right. I have questioned whether or not I'm really the right person for this particular job because the way my patience is set up,
listen.
Why would God give me this child? But then I answered it in my same sentence because my patience is set up like this, that's why he gave me him. Thank you, Jesus. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. I have to remind myself that daily. But no, seriously, that's so huge to be able to be okay with just planting the seed. Yes. And to just know that was the job, was to right. plant the seed, and the rest is not up to us. It is so far out of our control.
Yeah.
And it's so important in every aspect. And so you dropping parent gems before you even became a parent, girl. You didn't even know it. You didn't even know it. So listen, I'm going to come back after you have your kids, and I'm going to ask you if you still feel the same. If you still feel that same, that same glow just from dropping the seed, even though your child is out acting a whole plum fool, like you didn't say nothing to them at home. Because I'd be like, but I didn't raise you like that. So why? I don't understand why you're living your life this way. I just don't get it. Totally like went left with that, but that was so good. That's I'm gonna have to like that was a good nugget. That was good. So I listen, you feel like a unicorn to me because I just feel like there just have to be more people like you in this position because it's such an important piece.
Yeah.
Your whole story is just a unicorn story, like your parents and how invested they were and what an awesome job they did in making you comfortable.
Yes.
And not just comfortable, but like proud of who you are and who they are and y'all's story together.
Yes.
Really is just such a testament to what an amazing job they did. And for you to be kind of like the guinea pig kid, like,
right.
Let's try it out on her and see how this works out.
Yeah, for real.
Tell them they have my stamp of approval. Like it means anything, right? It means nothing. But I love to see how this all kind of like came together. And it's really just a beautiful story. And so, of course, you know, hearing your story initially, obviously, I immediately thought of Randall Pearson from This Is Us, right?
Yes.
Obviously. Like, everybody's been thinking it for the past, like, 30 minutes, right? Like,
exactly.
This Is Us. How similar, like, do you watch that show and feel like, oh my God, this is my life? Or, like, do you feel disconnected from it? Like, how does that feel?
I feel like it's my life. I love that show. And the producers of that show did phenomenal in showcasing the transracial adoptee side of it. And then the foster care side of it when they have their foster daughter. They did their research.
Let me tell you,
it was beautiful and amazing. And there were two, I watch it and there were two moments where I was like, that's my life. Like, for real, for real. And one of them was, it was when Randall was younger and he had that black teacher. You remember?
Yes.
And he like loved him.
Yeah.
And Jack was all like tweaked about it.
Yeah.
Whatever. And he was comparing Randall's blackness to, you know, racism, to classism.
Right.
Because he grew up poor.
Right.
And Randall was like, no, dog,
no.
That ain't it.
Like, no. Not the same.
My parents didn't do that, but other people in my life did.
Yeah.
You know, and they were trying to relate to me, and they couldn't. And that's okay. I think people just try so hard to relate. And sometimes you just have to take that step back and say, listen, I empathize with you, but I don't understand your experience because it's not my experience.
Right.
And that would have led to a different conversation with his son than the one that they had.
Yeah. Racism is a tough one because everybody wants to feel like they can understand
and they can't. Right.
And they can't. I had to have a conversation with someone who was comparing their child having to get vaccinations to racism.
Oh gosh, listen.
And so you know, I'm laughing, but it's not funny because that's something ridiculous that a lot of people do. That I, you know, and this is no shade to any other section of people, but I feel like I see people that in the LGBTQ community do it, and you know, people with disabilities have done it, and each of those carry their own weight on their own.
Absolutely,
it does not need to be compared to my blackness because it's not the same. And especially saying it to a black person is only going to drive a wedge so much bigger than you can ever imagine between them.
Exactly.
You think it's going to make us closer, and it's actually making me never want to talk to you ever again in life.
Period. Yes.
So it is one of those things that there is no comparison, and it's something that we know you can't ever understand. And so just to say that is more than enough. And I think, you know, that's a really good piece for transracial, you know, parents of, you know, that are in that transracial position or even interracial.
Right.
You know, a white mom will not understand the plight of a mixed child.
No.
It's just not going to happen because I walk into a room and my blackness, it will never leave me.
Right.
It's not hidden.
I'm not passing as anything besides black.
This is me. This is it. And it's a difficult conversation to have, but it needs to be said. And the comparison really is unnecessary. I'll just leave it at that. did you ever feel like your parents being white caused like a disconnect emotionally from them?
Yes, because I internalize everything. I am the poster child for silent suffering. And so I had a lot of feelings, you know, like we talked about earlier, loss and grief. And just, God, why I gotta live with these white people?
Right.
Why about my white people? And those were things I know my parents would have moved heaven and earth to not make me feel that way. And if they couldn't help, they would have found someone that I could confide in. But I wasn't at a place where I could articulate that and verbalize that to them or to anyone. So I just kind of sat there dwelling on that for years. So it did cause an emotional disconnect because I was just letting all of this happen inside of me. And my siblings were younger. So while they were also black children in the same experience, you know, when I was going through this in my early teen years, they were still in elementary school, you know, not caring about it as much.
Right. Right.
And so it there was a lot of loneliness.
Yeah. Very isolating experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's deep. Do you think you would consider transracial adoption?
Well, here's the thing. So, I definitely want to foster and adopt. And I'm not going to not allow any child into my home. My door is open to any child that needs a loving family and a home. I will say, because of my experience, I definitely feel called to helping children of color.
Yeah.
And allowing them to have an in-home experience.
Yes.
Even more developed than mine, since I am black. And so that would be my hope. I would definitely take in any child of any race, but I do, you know, I love my brown babies. And I would love to give a black child that experience.
What advice do you have for someone planning to adopt that may end up having that transracial experience?
Yeah. So their likelihood of that is high with the disproportionate amount of children in the system
yeah.
that are of color. I would say two things. One, they need to look at their village. You know, we always hear it takes a village. What mm-hmm. does your village look like? Because if there are not people of color, that child will feel isolated and like mm-hmm. they're the only one. And I think that's hard. That's really hard for a child to go through. And I would also say, do that self-assessment. If you would not be willing to go to a Black Lives Matter rally, or if you would feel uncomfortable taking that child to an all-Black church, or not, you would feel uncomfortable, you know,
the barbershop.
Being in a Black barbershop. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Then that's not for you, because you're going to be doing an extreme disservice to that child, and they will inevitably have an identity crisis if you are not taking the steps needed for that child to have connections to their culture.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my advice.
Yeah, I think that's amazing advice. And I really hope and pray. I have several friends that do have transracial adoptions. And, you know, it's always tough for me to, like I said, I don't want to be the one to be like, you know, if you just did this,
right.
Because you don't know where things are a choice and where things are because they don't know.
Yes.
And that's really big, because, you know, I might walk in sometimes and my boys might be a little bit nappy headed. It just is it's an off week. This week right. is my choice for them to be nappy headed. Next week, it's on my agenda. I'm thinking right. about it.
And exactly. then
someday I'm going to go. But with three whole boys, like, it takes up my whole life. So some days, some weeks, we just can't make it.
Right.
And sometimes we show up real ashy because I got three boys and they don't listen when I tell, you know,
exactly.
it's a long list of reasons why we show up the way we show up.
Yes.
And so, God forbid I judge you for how you showed up today, because maybe you just having the same type of day that I'm
right.
having.
Yes.
And I can't judge your whole parental experience off of this one interaction.
Right.
But I will say, the friends that I do have that are, in transracial adoption situations, I do feel like they gravitated towards us, I would like to say on purpose.
Which has its pluses and minuses.
It does. It, for me, I've only experienced the positive. I haven't experienced anything negative. I took it as, I decided to look at it from a positive perspective and say, because we've always lived where we were pretty much the only.
Right.
And so, you know, for those parents to gravitate towards us, I feel like has to be kind of, I mean, my kids are great. They're dope, but.
Right. But like,
you know, there's also a point where it's like, okay, I see you, but I'm cool with that because it helps my kids too. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I'm never too. They're friends because we have a whole host of Black folks in our family,
right?
You know, and we're gonna music on and Black culture. They're gonna have those experiences, and so they're not lacking in any way, shape, or form when we live right. in these, you know, communities or whatever.
For sure,
they're gonna get it. You know, I can't say the same for some of the other people that we come in contact with, and so those relationships are really meaningful for them.
Yes.
And even just to be able to have these types of conversations is really important. And so I respect the parents that make that effort. And so I think I just, like I said, I praise you. I praise your parents. I think you guys are basically the poster for everything that can go right in this situation. And I think it's important to highlight too, though, that even with everything that they did right, you still had struggles, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the important thing, because as parents, we want to guard our children from having these experiences, right? Like, I'm sure your mom would still be crushed to hear you say, I still had an identity crisis, even though you did all of that work,
right.
I still had this experience. That's heartbreaking for a mom to feel like you couldn't protect your child from that hurt or that pain or that experience.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important to note for parents that may be in this situation to understand, even when you do your best, there's still going to be some things, some places where you're going to come up short, because it just is what it is.
Absolutely.
I'm a Black mom raising Black men. Obviously not alone. I have a husband, but there are certain things I spend the majority. I'm a stay at home mom. So I spend more of my time with them than he does.
Right.
It's just a fact. It's just math. It's, you know, it just is what it is. And so there are certain things that I can't give them as a woman.
Right. Absolutely.
And no matter how much I pour into them and no matter how much I, you know, bake cookies, Lord knows I ain't baking no cookies. No matter no matter how hard I try, there's still going to be places that I'm going to come up short because I'm not a Black man.
Right.
And so it just is what it is. And I think that when people can accept that piece of it, that there's always going to be a piece missing.
Right.
Then that's the biggest piece to just find P-I-E-C. That's the biggest piece to find P-E-A-C-E. Find
yes. P-E-A-C-E. Yes. Yes. And it's not personal, right?
Yes.
It's not.
Yes.
They're being adopted. Like I said, it's grief. It's loss. There's nothing can fill that void that I have wondering about my birth family. It doesn't matter how amazing my parents were. There's always going to be those questions and wondering what life would have been like.
Yeah.
And so even in going back to This Is Us with Rebecca and Jack, like they were able to humble themselves and really look at the broader scope of things to realize that no matter what, Randall still loves them. And he views them as his parents, but there are things, like you said, that they cannot fill.
Yeah. Yeah. We can't even as birth parents, you can't be everything to your child.
Exactly.
It is what it is. This was excellent. 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 This was such a great conversation. Yes. I am so grateful to you. Thank you for taking the time out to sit with me and chat with me. I think lives will definitely be changed from this podcast episode and also just from the work that you do. I want to be the first to thank you for what you do and what you're putting back out into the community is really amazing. And I think whenever you get to the point where you actually are an adoptive mom,
yes,
the child will have such an amazing experience because you're just a gem. I love you.
Thank you so much. I thank you for allowing me to kind of tell my story and hopefully educate some people as well.
Yes, yes, it's important, and hopefully we always stay in a space where we always want to learn and we never feel like we know everything there is to know. You know, like I said, I was very ignorant to some things, and now hearing, you know, through your journey and other people's, I'm able to say like, man, I really didn't know that. And so it's really important to just, like you said, continue to build your village and gain those experiences because life doesn't come with a manual. It comes with a mom.